not speak it tonight.
All right, Christian Wepe from Chicago.
Yes.
And a visitor in different places, but somehow I'm affiliated. You can ask me about that if you're interested. I'm going to tell you, all right, without further ado, I'm just going to start. Let me just see what time it is. All right. So, thanks for being here. Monday, early morning for me. I'm going to tell you about a project I've been doing for the last couple of years, mainly with Eliseo Ferrante and Ali Turgut. They're both in Brussels now, although Eliseo is Italian and Ali Turkish. And I'm just going to mention a couple of other things I've done. One of them, important as an inspiration for this work, was something a project I had with Ian Cousins' group in Princeton that just finished and we had for the last 4 years or so. So that's why I say featuring, and I have to thank the National Science Foundation in case my bill. For this group, probably I don't need to do much of an introduction to the problem of collective motion. I used this excuse to show these nice videos. I started looking at microscopic animals. I think that what I'm going to tell you about applies to microscopic systems. I'm kind of interested in that possibility, so at least as a general concept. But I'm often thinking in terms of microscopic animals, so I think of that while I'm speaking and give examples from that perspective. Of course, it's an interesting system. It's an active system. In many ways, it's the simplest active system in the sense that it's one of the simplest ways in which you can put energy, mechanical energy, and get some kind of self-organization. And that's why people have been studying it already for a couple of decades. The people I worked with, actually, Eliseo and Ali, they're mechanical engineers. I got very much inspired to this project, if this computer reacts. Through this robotics perspective, it doesn't really matter if the videos play or not. They're just kind of cute. It's interesting to think. I always think that it's interesting to think it from this problem from very different perspective. I find it very inspirational, and in particular, in the case of robotics, they're dealing with other kinds of tasks. They're considered, but at the same time, which have a parallel in the biological system world, right? So you have. Also, the idea that it has to be a decentralized, scalable, and robust system, right? Like what one would hope that biological systems are. And there's additional constraints like communication and bandwidth of communications, et cetera, et cetera. These days, there's a lot of activity in the engineering community in this. There's a whole lot of people who kind of don't believe in swarms. Anyway, it doesn't play, but it doesn't matter. But at the same time, because they think, you know, a little bit of too fantastic right now, but there's more and more platforms, and I'll show you the videos eventually, where you can actually do these experiments, right? And there's a bunch of big projects that are doing this. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. That never played. All right, so I'm going to take a couple of minutes because lots of people here are very familiar with the subject to give a couple of random thoughts that I've been thinking about these last 2 weeks. The first one is that I've been working on this for a long time. I actually, probably not too many people have papers on this around 2003. So that's over 10 years ago. So I was working on this before it was cool, as I like to say. At the time, nobody really knew what the Wigczyk model was. If you spoke to physicists, nobody had a clue. And flocking systems, they didn't really think in those terms. It's been really interesting for me to see how this subject has evolved. Essentially, what we did at the time with Max, we were both postdocs at the University of Chicago, was some connection between this 2003 paper on general statistical physics, which was some connection between the idea of interactions, long-range interactions that happen because you're moving in these systems, and just imposed long-range interactions in networks. So, and at the end of the day, there's a calculation there that was a little bit of tour de force, which ends up being pretty much the mean field solution to the Wigczyk model. And the second one is, like, I think that we were the first to observe that the fluctuations of the Wigczyk model were non-Gaussian, that you know, you were kind of ordered and then suddenly it scrambled completely around. And that was an interesting thing to see, and it surprised us, and I think it surprised Tamás also, when we discussed at some point. But that was a while ago. Now there's a lot of research on this. There's a lot of people here who have been looking at things related to the hydrodynamic description of collective motion. I'm not really going to talk about that, and I'm happy about that because probably you all know much more than me about these things. I find it interesting that hydrodynamics can be here self-propelled agents on a fluid, or it can be a fluid of self-propelled agents, or I guess a combination of both. You now are thinking many times of things like active complex fluids, and I think that that can have some connection to what I'm talking about. And I would summarize the paradigm of thought is often is a little bit like a fluid of aligning spins or a self-energized advection in some ways, right? So you have either a field that is aligning in one way or another, like spins, or you have advection that is being pushed by, you know, a driving force, right? And otherwise somewhat standard hydrodynamic equations. But then there's all kinds of interesting additional terms that appear, and there's a lot of work that has been done, which is really fascinating. And I learn every time I come to these conferences about, you know, the next steps that are being taken. There's also a whole group of people who have specialized more in agent-based analysis. And then you start seeing, in the case of collective motion, what kind of agent-based interactions produce collective motion. So just at what point can you just figure out from a disordered initial state that systems that are perhaps very long range with respect to the, very large with respect to their range of interactions, they can manage to at least pick up a common direction, achieve some consensus in their direction of motion. And there's ways that are a little bit alternative to the typical alignment paradigm. One is escape pursuit, which I think is quite interesting. And then there's a whole discussion about when that corresponds to explicit or implicit alignment in one way or another. For me, since the beginning, what has been fascinating about this problem is how active systems self-organize. Right? And I think it's a really deep question because at the end of the day, there's a lot of biology that goes through that. So one essential characteristic for me of biological system is that you need to sort of structure energy before you can use it as work, right? You can organize energy before you can use it at work. And a collective motion system is a very simple system where you can start kind of tackling this problem. All right, so probably most of you know about this, but I will remind it or tell it to the ones who don't know. When I started this, the paradigm of collective motion was the Wigczyk model. And the Wigczyk model is pretty much like an aligning system, a little bit like a ferromagnetic material, a bunch of spins that need to align somehow. But where instead of having your spins on a lattice, you actually put a booster behind so that they start moving in the direction which they're pointing. And there was a bunch of interesting things that appeared immediately. Well, I guess, I don't know how immediately, but was public immediately as soon as it was published, at least, or as soon as Tamás and other people start thinking about this, which was that the system organizes, which was not trivial at the time. Why would it organize? So the Wigczyk model is just this equations, but if you want to think of it graphically, it's just that a bunch of point-like particles, which have no attraction-repulsion, it's collective motion for physicists, and they're only aligned, and they're advanced in the direction of motion. They advance at constant speed. So the only important rule is how they turn. And what they do is that at every time state, they take the average direction of motion of their neighbors, and then they turn in that direction of the average direction of their neighbors, those that are within a certain interaction range. But they don't do it exactly so that it's more interesting. There's a noise term. So there's a cone of indetermination there. So they turn somewhere in there, and then they advance. And they all do that in parallel at the same time, and then they just move. The thing is that if you put these things in a lattice, they will never organize long range in two dimension. Right? There's a Mermin-Wagner theorem that tells you that this cannot happen, at least for infinite ranges, for long ranges. But when you put them in a periodic box and they actually advance, they actually do align. And that was kind of their first result. When you look at the order parameter, and we will hope that this one plays great. When you look at the order parameter, which is just the degree of alignment, it's 1 if they're aligned and 0 if they're disordered. As you increase the noise, they go from an ordered state to a disordered state. This was a snapshot from the initial original paper. Later, there's been a whole discussion, the fact that this is not really second order. It seems to be pre-established that it's first order, but it's very weakly first order, which is actually an interesting question. Why is it so weakly first order? But anyway, but I digress, I guess. So that's the ordered state. It's not fully ordered. There's some level of noise, but it's still different than the disorder state where you can't really pick up any bias direction where they're going. So they were talking at the time of a novel type of phase transition, which would produce this level of order because it's out of equilibrium and because it doesn't follow the constraints of the Mermin-Wagner theorem. That's the order state again. So here let me switch to another component of how I got to this, to the question I really want to tell you about in a few minutes, which is the work I did with Ian and people from his group. Now they're all professors, I guess, except for Yael, who went to the private industry. Those are a couple of publications we did at the time based on this experiment. So the experiment was, the purpose of the experiment was to see what macroscopic animals were really doing, right? Rather than just impose a model or something like that. So we put them in a quasi two-dimensional environment, a very shallow tank, and we let them swim around and put a camera over it. And this was already maybe 5 years ago when they started doing this. 4 years ago, we started getting some results. And at the time, there's other people who have done the same thing, but at the time, I think it was quite new. And this is what comes out with about 1,000 fish, I guess. This is accelerated a few times, 4 or 5 times. You even see the camera above the tank there in reflection. You have all kinds of interesting dynamics. You have the fact that these things sometimes align, sometimes start turning. Sometimes they have this interesting kind of catastrophic switches of direction, which seem to be self-generated. There's a whole lot of rich dynamics. There's a whole lot of data. And to be quite honest, there's a whole lot to do with that data, with those data, because it's not so easy to analyze them and to extract every possible information. So they're there, and I'm sure we could share them because there's other data coming out every day. That was just free swimming, right, on the tank. So one of the things that we did with that experiment was to try to take a naive perspective. And in fact, we did something much less interesting than analyzing those movies that I just showed. We just considered first two fish on the tank, right? So it's a much more lonely and boring scenario. But we have the advantage that we could leave them there for hours at a time and just record what they were doing. And they seemed to be perfectly happy. And as soon as you had two of them, they seemed to start swimming around in tandem. So then you could really see how they were interacting, at least at that two body level. And what we did was try to take a sort of model-free approach where we would just consider the all possible interactions they could have, right? Their relative positions, their relative speed, their relative angle, their accelerations, their absolute speed, you know, all kinds of things. Because in reality, we as physicists tend to think, you know, you have some kind of interactions, but these things could be paying attention to anything, right, that the other neighbors were doing. So we looked at this, what we could call social forces, taking language from social sciences, meaning, you know, forget about hydrodynamics. These fish are pretty strong, and they can go wherever they want, even if they have a lot of drag on their way, right? So essentially, we're just measuring here social forces. So then we see what acceleration we observe for a given configuration. And we do that for a lot of data, right? And so these are possible. Sure. One fish doesn't school in this particular case. It doesn't. Yeah, it feels lonely and it barely moves most of the time. Yeah, and it goes to a corner. You know, it's like a completely.
It doesn't swim around.
One.
We've been doing similar things in Toulouse, and in fact, it's true that most fish, one guy, and is going to go to a boundary.
Yeah.
And mostly stay there. We have lots of data, and
sometimes they do something, yeah.
But, you know, to extract data in the middle of the tank, we need
right, on top of it.
But who already is doing symptoms?
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course,
yeah, of course. Oh no, of course it's very species dependent and very differently from the Toulouse case. These are very small fish, right? Oh, you're doing now a small fish. Okay, yeah, I know the large fish.
Kind of a rule that the only guy is alone.
Yeah, yeah, they tend to behave differently. And an interesting thing is that we also scaled a little bit, like 2, 3, 5 fish, stuff like that. And the interactions are not so different, at least at that level, right? So there's some residual that was part of the work that is published there, that the three-body interaction has some residual. That's kind of an interesting result. But that's a little bit away from what I wanted to talk about now. But that's an interesting observation indeed. One fish is too lonely to do much. So one thing that we did at the time was just look at when two fish were swimming, what kind of interactions they have. So the one of the strongest signal you get is position dependent. So this is where you find your neighbor, right? The focal fish is right here, pointing upwards, right? Like you see it here, right? And this is just the distance left-right and the distance from that. Right? And this is where you find your neighbor. So 90% of your time, you find your neighbor in this region here. And this is the force field, right? So essentially the acceleration that the focal fish has when the neighbor is in a given position. That's why it's the focal fish acceleration, right? That's why the arrows seem to be turned around, perhaps. But it coincides, right? So the region where you find the fish is where you have the small accelerations, and then it goes out. It should go in if we would be looking at the acceleration of the sample fish, you know, of the fish that is the neighbor, right? But that's one interesting thing that comes out. But then you can do other things. So for convenience, we divided these vectors into what we call speeding force and turning force, right? So essentially the acceleration in this direction and the acceleration perpendicular. That way we can plot this vector plot as a column, as a heat map, what is done here. So this is a speeding force. So it's the magnitude, as according to this scale, of the acceleration going forward. And this is the magnitude of the acceleration turning, right? And this is now with respect to other parameters. So here now we're taking the distance from back and the speed of the neighbor, right? So they're both moving and there's a certain speed, and now we just project these things in this direction to see if there's something that comes out. And indeed here there is something that comes out. You see here the fact that there's a distance-dependent interaction, which is kind of like the component here of that vector, the vertical component of that vector. But here you see that there's actually a speed dependence in the interaction too, which is, I can just point you to something very simple, which is the fact that you have this diagonal line here. So this is kind of the zero acceleration line, right? And what you're seeing here is essentially the faster the fish is going, both fish are going, the more distance they want to have from each other, right? Which is a little bit like when you're driving. So it's an intuitive thing, but it's interesting that it comes out very neatly with this with these data. But what I want to point you to mainly is this other interesting, which is more important for the story I'm going to tell today, which is the turning force. So now it's the way they're turning this direction, the acceleration in the perpendicular direction, I guess. And this is now the distance left-right, and now we're plotting here the relative heading angle. But just so you understand better, we put like the typical fish shear orientation, right? So here, what you're seeing is that this thing is turning right, this positive is turning right, when your fish is too much to the right, when your neighbor is too much to the right, and this guy is turning left, where your neighbor is too much to the left. That all makes sense. But what is interesting is that this is symmetric up and down. So essentially, if the guy is too much to the right, but he's turning left, you're still turning to the right. You know. So in fact, here you don't really have an explicit alignment. So the data is showing you that the fish is caring more about the distance of your neighbor rather than how your neighbor is aligned. Right? If that makes sense. So this is, in many ways, a little bit of a posteriori argument, because the way we got to this was, as I said, through robotics. Ali, I had worked with him before when he was a student. When I started, we did this interesting, this paper I mentioned to you before, where we did this analysis with networks, in which then there's a whole different line of research that I'm not going to tell about right now, which is a connection between the interaction networks and how these systems behave, that has continued after with adaptive networks, work we did with Thilo Gross and other people. But at the time, it was very interesting for them, because they were trying to reproduce alignment, Bikchuk-like interactions with robots. And the easiest way to do it was to just broadcast your orientation with a little compass in your robot and receive it somewhere else. But there was no real near-neighbor interaction. However, there was a limitation on how many neighbors you could be paying attention to because of the electronics. And it turned out to be that our network model was a very good model for that, because it had the same kind of like non-local limitations, but at the same time limitation of the number of inputs that you were getting, right, at a given moment in time. So we did that together, and then we continued working together, and then they were looking at problems in which you could achieve self-organization without having any alignment turn. And in their case, they were considered leaders and things like that, but we simplified it more and more. Because alignment in robotics is not a very natural thing to do. But distance and angle, you know, bearing and angle, what they call range and bearing, I guess, is something that is interesting. And these are essentially the publications I'm going to be telling you about now. And an underlying thing of all this talk that I think is very interesting is that I think there's an interesting paradigm change. And I always say that I might be the last person who realizes this, and that's why I put this cartoon in there. But maybe it's not so obvious. I don't know. All right, so we consider a limit case opposite to the Vychik model in many ways. So instead of having only alignment and point objects and a fluid dynamics where they're mixing all the time, we considered only position-dependent interactions. Okay, so I'm not going to talk about alignment. I'm going to talk about Vychik model is angle, relative angle-dependent interactions. You change your angle based on the relative angle with your neighbors. Right? Now we're only considering position-dependent interactions. So you react based only on the position of your neighbor. Right? You don't care about the angle of your neighbor. Right? So it's only relative position-dependent interactions. I'm going to consider a fixed interacting network, so they're really always interacting with the same neighbors. And in many ways, it's much more like an elastic membrane than like a fluid. So, and also, well, just like in the Vychik model, it's an overdamped and self-propelled dynamics. So this is what you should imagine, and it's neatly, it's like it has a mechanical analogy in many ways. This is like your little robots in many ways. I mean, that's why I'm drawing them like that. So you have these little wheels, so you can really only advance or turn. You can't really move sideways in this model in any way. But you first take your elastic forces to your neighbors. You have these springs, so they're just linear springs, harmonic potential springs. You know, like you can attract, repel. They have some natural length in which you can attract or repel, and you compute the resulting elastic forces. And then it's a very simple thing that you're doing. Once you compute the elastic forces, you pull these things from nodes, essentially. So you add the self-proportional term, and then you project the elastic forces in the direction of motion. And that's your speed in this direction, because it's over there. And then you just project the elastic forces perpendicular to that direction, and that's your turning rate, right? And that's what's summarized in these two equations. We also played around with the noise, so we included, just sort of historically because of the engineering motivation, what they call sensing noise in how you're measuring the forces, and what they would call actuation noise, which is here the angular part. And it really doesn't matter much. We tried other noises, and it doesn't seem to change at least what I'm going to tell you now. It may change other more subtle things.
So question, so the neighborship relations are fixed?
Yes.
It's a network which doesn't change?
It doesn't change, yes.
The alternative model would be actually
allowed for. Yes. I should comment that we started using like a Lunar-Jones, Morse potentials, etc. It seemed to produce the same effect. Of course, then you have dislocations and breakings and situations that can happen like that. Because of what we wanted to understand, we ended up setting on something that was completely fixed. And you probably understand in a minute why it makes it more easy to analysis. And then the mindset was we're going to take something opposite to the Vychik model, right? I mean, really go to the other limit, right, where you have fully fixed interactions. So this is the same thing I just told you with the added noise terms. And this is just the spring interactions, the linear forces. And this is just now the parameters. So we have the preferred speed, V0, which is just a scalar, the alpha and beta, which is just how much the elastic forces will couple to your speed and how much they will couple to your turning. And the n is the random heading rate, and then we have some random variable noise.
Can I have a question?
Sure.
So this preferred speed is along which vector? Along which direction?
So it's always along the heading direction, right? So you're always keeping track of each agent where they're pointing.
They are saying the spring force actually turns this right vector. But isn't this spring force like pairwise forces? How does it produce torque to reorient the?
It's pairwise forces. So you sum over all the spring interactions, right? But then once you have the vector, your final vector of forces, right? You're doing as if you would be pulling this from the nose, right? So it's like through an arm. So that's the component here.
So you basically say that this unit vector will align with this the force, total force.
Yeah, it will definitely.
That's the rule you implemented.
Yes, of course. And so there is so as opposed to your model, there is a coupling between the orientation and the elastic forces.
Right.
What is important, because there's a semantic discussion, is that it's still in the classical sense of the term, it's not an aligning force because it doesn't depend on the orientation of your neighbor. It only depends on the position of your neighbor, right? So that's just because sometimes, you know, I had lots of discussion with referees about that. So. I just want to clarify it. So this is what results from the model. So you see that, you know, we're starting it here. Here we're connecting through springs all nearest neighbors, right? So there are just 6 connections per agent. Here it's a similar thing. We're taking some local connections. So you create these structures that cannot be destroyed, right? But they can deform. And interestingly, you know, you start from a random initial condition in directions, and then eventually it either starts turning or it starts moving. This is a metastable state, but I showed it because it's more rare that these models produce these rotating motion. But here it's very natural, of course. And here is the displacement state in the chiasm of a bar, which was suggested at some point by Hugh some time ago.
So there have been model studies where one assumes that each particle will align with its own velocity, which in turn is determined by the interaction with the neighbors. So after friction, it's like aligning with the force.
Yes.
Okay, right? Which is sort of what you do. I guess
yes.
The difference is that these are cases in which the interactions are more like, let's call it the neutrons or just pulsing or whatever. So the neighbors can actually change. So the difference is that the neighbors cannot change.
Yes. So in fact, so yes. That's one.
Because
that's
also, this, but also show a lot of this kind of local rotation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's this, you know. So I was going to mention. So this model of act. It's a model that initially Tamás and used for these little bacteria groups, and then you and Silke did for the active jamming case, in which in many ways, we found it later while we were working on this. There's a bunch of similarities and there's some differences, and I think that it's actually interesting to compare because they are the only two models that we found that did this, actually.
So I wonder how they compare, especially at high density, when probably even the model with the particles could actually rearrange doesn't actually show a lot of.
Yeah.
So that's a
very interesting question. And then the other interesting thing is, in some ways, so usually that model you can move sideways, right? Because you can be pulled sideways, and then you align with a tau time constant to that direction, right? So when that tau constant is, I guess, very large or slow, large, right? It will become something like this, right? But otherwise, that model kind of relaxes more easily. Because it can decouple more easily the displacements with the elastic displacement with the turning, right?
Yeah, anyway, we can talk about.
Oh yeah, so that's an interesting parallel, and I was going to mention that in a minute when I get to the results actually, that's because it's interesting that's the only other model we found that does this actually, that self-organizes and achieves alignment, right? In any event, so when you increase the noise, this is just this actuation and angular, I guess, for the forces and on the angles noise. You see that for low noise, you get an order state, and for high noise, you get a disorder state. And in this case, it's quite clearly discontinuous transition, which is just what we're showing there. The other interesting thing is that this seems to happen for at least, as we can extrapolate numerically, for infinite systems, I guess, although I don't have a machine that computes that. But if we just plot for a given amount of noise, the level of order for an increasing size of system, so you see the scale here is 0.91, 0.89. If you put it in a log, it's almost the same because it's so small, right? So it just really converges to a certain finite amount. And this is kind of a fit with a log, assuming that there's a certain order at infinity, right? And kind of aligns reasonably well. So this seems to remain for very large systems. However, if you start from a completely disordered state, it takes longer to organize. Right, so interestingly, for a relatively small system, this N91, you get this rotating state, which are these that are down here. Right, this is ordered, but it's not aligned, right? So that's why you're seeing this. For a larger system, it's much harder to get, it's really impossible, I guess, at some point, to get the rotating state.
Yeah, what's yes.
It's a standard polarization, yeah. Yeah, in this case. That's why these rotating states look like this order. But I can tell you because we looked at them and they're... But interestingly, it doesn't, although it gets trapped in this kind of metastable state sometimes, it scales, I mean, this is just a guess more or less, but slower than n to the 1/2 the time it takes to converge. I'm rescaling the x-axis here as n to the 1/2, and you see that it becomes slower. Sorry? Oh, sorry. In this case, we consider an hexagonal case. When I don't mention, we usually take our typical case, which is an hexagon, right? And an initial condition is randomly oriented. All right. So what am I doing here with time? Okay, not so bad. So what I find neat, and it's this kind of paradigm thing, at least in my mind, which is nice, is that when you're thinking of, at least an agent-based model, collective motion from the Wigczyk perspective, it becomes a consensus problem. You know, they need to communicate their direction of motion somehow and achieve consensus of what direction is. When you're thinking about it here, it becomes something a little bit more complicated, and I didn't know very, very well how to think about it until I started thinking in these terms, in the terms of elasticity-based interaction. Right? And then it becomes very intuitive. So what we did to show that is we just grab our standard case, right, and we compute the normal modes, oscillation modes, right? So then you have the zero modes, I guess 1, 2 here, which are displacements, then you have rotation, and then you have these other elastic modes that are playing around. And these are just the 8 first ones. These are 91 particles, so therefore you have exactly 182 modes, right? One per degree of freedom. In two dimensions. And what I'm showing here is the hexagon case again, where they start from a random initial condition at their zero elastic force, so at their natural lengths, each neighbors, right, their perfect natural length, but they're randomly oriented. So initially they try to pull in any direction. Right? And so what you're seeing here is that the initial kinetic energy is the V0, it's given just by V0, right, because they have no elastic force initially. And the elastic energy is zero, but very quickly they start forcing. And then eventually they organize until at this point they're all parallel again. Right? And then the elastic forces are zero again, or very close to zero, and the kinetic energy is just the V0 times the number of V0 squares times the number of agents, right? Half. But this is what I find it interesting, is that if you just plot the energy per mode, and these are ordered in growing energy, right? In order of growing energy. You see that there are these kind of oscillations that appear, and that's a whole interesting dynamics that remains to be fully studied. But you also see that you have this sort of cascade towards lower energy modes, and eventually everything is fed to the lowest energy mode. Right? And sorry, go ahead.
Do we say classical lower mode analysis, like in classical mechanics?
Yeah.
Where we have masses. So what is the role of mass here?
For elastic energy, it doesn't really matter the mass, right? So if you think of kinetic energy, we're just defining it as one or something. It doesn't really matter at that level.
I mean, first thing, if there were different masses, one particle would be more massive than then you would have different normal modes.
Sure.
So, it's important that all the particles are the same and all the spin constants.
Well, I guess, right. So if we're considering the way... I mean, this calculation in particular, we did it for all masses the same and all spring constants the same. And the spring constants are, in this case, imposed. The mass, in this case, is irrelevant because it's overdamped, right?
But on the other hand, you have this directional vector, so this is some kind
of... Yeah, of course. Of course. I'm describing the way in which energy is distributed on the elastic modes, and I think at that point it doesn't really matter. Of course, you could do another decomposition where you would somehow take into account the direction of motion and the modes, the orientational parts, right? But that's a different problem. So in order to illustrate the role of elasticity, we just did this.
So your modes are defined as sort of the eigenvalues of the elastic matrix?
That's yes, exactly. Yeah.
Because, I mean, this is also exactly what happens in the models I was mentioning before.
Yeah.
There is actually a difference because, so particles align with their own velocity, which is in turn determined by the forces of the neighbors, with a time lag.
Right.
This time lag actually can show essentially the role of the mass.
I see.
So actually, is there mass in the system, mass in quotation?
Well, you have a point. I hadn't thought about it because indeed the fact that in this case you are turning as a speed, right? You have a speed of turning.
Yeah.
Essentially, it's like it's an equivalent to inertia, and therefore there's a mass. And I guess one could extract what that mass is, but in this case, because they're all the same, it would just be a normalizing function, right? So I mean, a normalizing quantity.
If you increase the centrifugal speed of your particles, yeah, start to propagate higher modes, because that looks like a zero temperature gradient descent, right?
So,
but you could imagine that you inject energy still because of the self-propulsion, and you have some noise because of the angular one. So I was wondering if by increasing velocity allows to kind of increase the temperature of some kind.
So the relaxation time would be longer for the same other parameters, but the fact that you've had this cascade will still be there. Exactly the way the fluctuations in that case would play the role, you know, there would be something about the angular noise and the speed that would play.
Basically, condensation in one of the.
Yeah. Yeah. In this case, yeah.
Kinetic energy and elastic energy, if you add them up, you should be somehow responsible for energy, or
do you have? No, because you're feeding energy here in. I guess you can just look at how they add, right? No, because at the end you will, you know, here you will, you see you start and you end at the in the same position. So I'm not sure if that's.
So in the end, after some time, this the thermal kinetic and elastic energy just
remain
constant,
right? Yeah.
Why?
Because eventually, in this case, they're just aligning and they're moving on a straight line, right? And if they're moving in a straight line.
But that movement should be somehow vacuum focused, right? You should actually, you have to add some energy to.
Yeah, but it's also being dissipated because it's overdamped, right? So you actually have a constant flow and then it gives you a constant quantity. So you want to look at it that way.
All right.
So this is kind of cute, actually. So the thing that I was going to say is that when I think of this as a cascade of modes, right, I think it's a very intuitive perspective because it's just like a drum, right? So if you kick a drum, you're exciting all kinds of elastic modes, right? But you end up always hearing your fundamental note or a string on a guitar or something. That's because in standard elasticity, you know, if it's nonlinear elasticity, you may have something like a cascade, but if you just even have linear elasticity where all the modes split out, the higher modes will dissipate faster than the lower modes. And the very simple realization that I find kind of fascinating as a way of thinking of active systems is the fact that elasticity, once you add activity, can become a mechanism for self-organization. I mean, when I see a simulation of you know, Game of Life, right, of the 80s or something, And even the group split or something is almost magical, right? The fact that they manage to self-sort or things like that. But when I think of standard elasticity and think that higher modes are dampened quicker than lower modes, it's kind of trivial. It's basic physics, right? So now if I combine activity and elasticity, sometimes the fact that the higher modes tend to dampen quicker becomes a mechanism for self-organization. And I think that that can be an interesting idea. And with this idea of the sound, so that's the sound of an active symbol, right? So that's, if you recompose that into this, into sound, that's what it would sound like. And I think, I actually believe that in some decades, perhaps we'll get active drums out there.
Probably not through this mechanism, but some kind of active stiffening or stuff like that, you would definitely get a different sound.
And you could imagine ways in which with micro engineering you could do this. It's kind of a fun idea. Anyway, so let me go back to this this movie that I showed you before. And now that I told you about the elastic aspect of this, you can really see it in this case, which I find quite neat, because you see the bending modes. And you see that from an initial random condition here, their grayscale corresponds to how locally aligned the system is. You can see this visiting all the, you know, bending modes, right? And then sort of cascading to lower bending modes. Right? Until you get to like the first bending mode, you know, this is like the second, third, I don't know. And then you get to this one. And then eventually, I cut it before, but eventually this whole thing starts moving in one direction. A neat thing about this is that then the direction of self-organization is actually, you know, given by the elastic properties of the material. You can imagine that, because the way that these things are end up visiting the lower modes, by the time they're in the first bending mode, they're almost all pointing somehow in this direction. So you would expect that when they get to the zero mode, they will go in that direction too. All right, so another neat thing about these systems is that because there's standard elasticity, you can, you know, it's easier than fluid dynamics in many ways, and you can just do a very straightforward linear stability analysis and see in which cases, at least, you know, this is very trivial, it's just like what is the linear perturbations of the perfectly aligned state in which they're moving in one direction with zero noise. But even that tells you something. Because here, what it's telling us is that for zero noise, this thing will always organize, because the essentially stability criterion here is always smaller than zero, whatever that is in this case, because it's a cubic polynomial, it comes out, so it's a little tricky. You need to consider the displacement fields, elastic displacement fields, and the orientation field of each one locally of your agents, and this is a continuous approximation for an infinite sheet, elastic sheet. And then you get that as long as this is true, you will be stable. So that's already something that is interesting, because, in fact, you could think that this is almost trivial by everything that I showed to you before. But at the same time, if we tested many other models, many other ways in which you could couple elastic forces and orientations, essentially, it didn't organize mostly, except for that exception, which I was going to mention now, but now I mentioned already. And you could think, like, well, what happens if I just consider a constant speed? So I don't couple the elastic forces to my speed, I just couple them to my angle. So I still have kind of the alignment term, quote unquote, right, in which the orientation I'm moving. But it's easy as a calculation here, because a constant speed is just putting alpha, which was the coupling of elastic forces to the speed, equals zero. And if I do that, and I compute the linear stability analysis, it gives me that the eigenvalues are always imaginary, and indeed, if this reacts right, if you start this, for whatever reason, this movie goes back and forth, but in any way, these things are just turning in place. If you start them even perfectly aligned, just because of sort of numerical noise, they just start turning in place. So if you wouldn't have coupled this to the speed, then it doesn't self-organize. Right, so it's not such a trivial effect in many ways. And again, it makes some sense if you think of it from the point of view elasticity, because essentially as you're turning, you're kind of feeding too much energy to higher modes as you're trying to adjust your direction. Right, and then the sort of cascade mechanism can happen. Another thing that we tried is to consider a less crystalline system. Right, so this is an arbitrary shape that fits on a PRL figure. What we're doing is that we put two holes and we did something kind of square, and we just randomly distributed homogeneously within the region that we allowed it to, excluding these two holes, etc. And then we wired everybody who was within a certain interaction range with springs, with natural lengths, exactly the one that happened to be the initial condition, so that it produced like a disordered membrane. And we're just coloring them from angle by angles. And then again, you see that this organizes, and you also see the coarsening because of the nice color display that you see there, how the regions start growing, and then eventually starts moving in a given direction.
I have a question.
Sure.
I'm still thinking about the proceedings slide. I mean, the way you look at this is you take a spring network, and you do what the mathematicians call homogenization. So you go from a spring network to a continuum.
Sure.
Yeah. This is actually non-trivial. If you talk to the mathematicians, they say that even the 2D case is not well defined. So, I mean, how do you get the elastic constants from the spin?
No. For that calculation, we didn't map that to the actual springs, right? And in fact, that's something that I wanted to do, but I haven't gotten around to doing. And I think, I was asking around some people, and at least someone sent me a thesis where it's supposed to be done. So I agree, it's non-trivial, but.
Some simple arguments. What he's basically doing is he's taking three modes, and then he looks for agreement between the Springer-Berg and the model, and then he identifies a constant. But that's not a rigorous calculation, okay? A rigorous calculation is actually not, I'm not sure if it exists.
Well, according to, so I haven't had time to look at these thesis, but according to the people, that was what was there. I agree with you, but we haven't even dealt with that problem because we only looked at, the continuous approximation separate from the constants of the spring network. So, but that's, again, one thing that remains to be done. I would love to be able to do that to match the quantities with simulations. Right. So this was just, you see that it's going out of the screen already. So these were just parameter exploration to see how generic this effect is. And at least as much as we pull them around, they seem to always end up doing this. In this case, they rotate. I think eventually we'll start translating that one up there. But
what was beta?
Beta is the coupling between the turning and the elastic forces. So alpha is the coupling between the elastic forces and the speed. Beta, the turning and the elastic force. I just have a couple of minutes, but I think I just wanted to show you a couple of quick things. Again, there's a lot to be done, and I'm actually very happy to be able to talk to you about this because I'm really hoping that people will get interested in this. I mean, there's essentially most of this is, Eliseo and Ali can help me a lot with the simulations, but they're not physicists, so most of what I'm telling you, it's just me working a lot, right? So I'd be happy, in collaborations with other people that are starting now. So there's a lot of this which just kind of touched the tip of the iceberg from my perspective. One of these is this, I thought that this would be something quite simple, but of course there's this interesting, the fact that if you have just a ring, right, so there's no elastic forces that allow, you can always deform this with zero force, right? In some regime at least, you end up getting this long-term dynamics where you first have an oscillation and then you have this small disformation that appears. Another thing that can be interesting is to study heterogeneous systems. What we're doing here is considering a situation that is much more accelerated because it takes forever, but we're considering a system where each agent has a randomly drawn preferred speed between 0 and 1 or something like that, right? So some of them don't want to even move at all, they're just being dragged, and the other ones are being dragged, right, by the rest. And you can probably detect which ones are which because of how much they're wiggling their tail. So the fast ones have to wiggle a lot in order to adjust to the other ones because they're pushing like this, etc. And eventually, it turns and then eventually it moves like this. And I guess by chance, slower ones ended up being at this side than on this side. So it moves a little bit, turning like that. And then I think that I'm just on time, so that's great. I guess so. Then there's this. So then just as a final thing is some things that we're looking at now. So an obvious thing to do is compute the dispersion relation in these systems. We're actually working with that with Naomi. She's a postdoc at the University of Chicago, working usually with Tom Witten, but also taking some time to work on this with me. It's fairly complicated expression, but it's analytical. It's just really long, so we're actually looking at approximations, which is kind of neat. And I find that quite interesting because by now people using the paradigm of the Wittig model were even trying to think of ways they could measure the dispersion relations, Wittig style dispersion relation, which are again different in direction motion than perpendicular to the direction motion in large fishery tanks and things like that. So this would tell you that if these are qualitatively different, you could actually compare and see to what extent it obeys one mechanism or the other mechanism. And I don't expect, of course, any real macroscopic agent or microscopic agent to really fully obey this system, right? It's probably a combination of alignment of some sort or other interactions or fluid interactions and elastic forces. But this could play a role. And I find it really interesting the fact that by measuring these sort of macroscopic quantities, you could figure out which mechanism is playing what level of role. And this is just a
simulation that we did for something else, so
we kind of have one of these hexagons with much more agents, and we then pull them from this direction after they're moving to the right, and then you see how the that propagates this way. Precisely, one of the things that we were thinking about was, you know, this work on the Starling project, Starflag project, where they were measuring the dynamics of birds, and there's a lot of publications that they've done somehow suggesting in one way or another that the fact, because they measure long-range correlations, right? So they measured scale-free correlations, meaning when they have big groups of starlings, the correlation lens in the speed and the orientation is somewhat trivial, I guess, but the speed is much less trivial, scales as the size of their system, right? So they have this scale-free correlations, and they associate this with the fact that this may be close to a critical point. In fact, what we see in this case, because we just were testing it very quickly, is that when you think of this as an elastic system, and if you have this fact that you are cascading to lower modes, of course, eventually, under many perturbations, you will start visiting the collective modes. And therefore, I claim that maybe what they're seeing is just the influence of this effect, coupled probably with some alignment interaction. And in fact, if we just do the correlation length, that this is just one of these examples for a given size, you know, it typically gives us something that more or less cuts at the middle of the group, right? And then for bigger groups, it scales with the system size, just like what they have in their PNAS from a few years ago. So it's not, I don't know. So maybe it's that, maybe it's what they're saying, but I think that it's important to remember that, you know, this system also has attraction repulsion. It's not like you can't just forget about it because it's convenient as a physicist, right? It's like it's there, right? And there may be this interesting thing. The thing that I wanted to mention particularly here is that, you know, this for some microscopic systems is somehow artificial. But there could be other microscopic systems where there would be some kind of active elasticity, like a stiffening or a growing or, you know, deformation or whatever you can think of, right? That could follow a same kind of mechanism. Also, this kind of cascading of elastic modes. And I'm kind of fishing for a system that could be that. And if I learned anything of working in biological systems from the point of view of physics, is that if there's a physical mechanism to do something, biology uses it somewhere, right? Maybe in combination with other things, but it uses it somewhere. So I really would expect this to appear somewhere in a biological system, maybe a small scale system. And finally, another thing that I find interesting is that now, because you can build these structures, right, even in a simulation, so now give me 1,000 of these agents, right, and let me tune for each one of them, their alpha, their beta, their V0, and their K, and their L0, their natural length, their spring constant, the couplings, and their preferred speed. And I can build a bicycle, right? I can build whatever I want. I can build something that has structure that functions in a certain way, and even that somehow self-organizes to function in a certain way because of this thing that I was saying before, that the elasticity properties of a given subset of the group will determine how that subset of the group moves. So I find that can be a really interesting model for some kind of like self-organization in biological systems in general. So there's a lot of things that could be done that, and then I guess I'm just going to leave that at the end, and thank you for your attention. Thanks.
So you said you have a lot of data for the fish.
Yeah.
Back when you were working on. Mm-hmm. So have you looked in that case at how often, if ever, they change on animals?
So in the case of the fish, they have, it depends on the regime, I would say. But there are many regimes in which they don't, there's a whole dynamical process that occurs at a time scale at which they're not changing at all their name, right? I guess that's what I can say.
And you mentioned at the beginning, I can't remember exactly what you said, that one could imagine using, say, Langer-Johnson interaction,
sure,
instead of springs. So have you done that? Or?
Yeah, that's how we started it. Yeah.
So in that case, in principle, they can change neighbors. Mm-hmm. But these high density disorganized region of phase space, how often does that happen?
Well, I mean, then it depends on the potential a lot, right? So you can put a soft potential where they're almost like a droplet, but they still have, you know, a viscoelastic kind of effect. And you can have a very strong potential where it becomes really something like that. We typically looked at relatively strong regimes, but there were many situations where we had the system systematically breaking into pieces and coming back together, and then we kind of put periodic boundary conditions so that they would re-encounter, and then there's a whole set of things that are happening that, you know, we wanted to understand the simple things first, I guess. But yeah, that's I find that a very interesting thing to see, because one thing that I would be very curious about is when you have a very soft potential and they're changing a lot, their neighbors, can you still identify something like this mechanism? For a strong potential, we did see it, but with only several dislocations, if I may say, or breakings, right, in the typical dynamics. But for something where it's continuously, somehow fluidized, right, we haven't really studied it. Right, in your case, it's self repulsion. Yeah.
And yet, they're still aligned.
Yeah.
Yeah, but in that case, because
you were confined, and because, I mean, at least in the sense that.
But if you do you look at the model of the reality boundary.
I see.
Forget the confined. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were looking at something else, but you still get
that. Sure. Yeah, no, I would think so, yeah. Yeah.
One system which immediately fits your criterion of a necessity-based self-organization would be cells in matrix.
Yeah, I heard that.
Cells in matrix. I mean, what we are working on since a long time.
I see.
So you basically have the extracellular matrix in your body, like connective tissue, mm-hmm. collagen cells and stuff, and then you have cells in it, and they actually interact with the there are many things which are different in detail.
Right, of course.
So one point here is that the way you look at the systems is actually two components. And you have the matrix mm-hmm. and you have the cells. Mm-hmm. Here you cover them into one network. But the way you look at this is the cells, they attach to the matrix, they contract and interact, but they also can let go, they might get to another place, they will change neighbors. Okay. And I think the biophysics is a little bit different than what we do here, but this idea is very similar.
Okay, that's great. We should talk more. We'd be interested in.
You see, there's a long tradition in engineering to look at the systems, and what they usually do is it's called mixture models. Mm-hmm. So you have different components or phases, and they write down interaction terms, and it's very complicated.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I hope we're.
I realize that in your system, what is really very interesting is this very. Put everything in the same framework, okay? The motion and the elasticity.
Right. It's as simple as we could do it in many ways, you know, so we could understand something, or at least so I could understand something.
I was just wondering about the effect of dimensionality. So, in this level, in terms of like social forces in 3D, and how does that like actually affect
them? So, you're talking about the experiment case or the.
I guess the whole thing.
So in the case of elastic interaction, that's something that I would love to do. I just haven't had time to. To see really, I mean, does this translate identically to 3D? I mean, I don't see why not, but at the same time, could be that it not. You know, I don't have a strong argument at that point. In the case of the fish, again, I think it depends a lot on the species. And for this particular species, one of the reasons why we confine them in that depth and everything is because it's not so far from their natural environment. And even when they're in deeper thing, they tend to swim more or less in a flattened way, which is not so rare in some biological systems. I mean, they don't always use the three dimension. And it has to do probably with their sensing, right? They have a lot to, you know, they have a, it's mainly visual, the way that they school. And I guess that makes some sense to them. But yeah, there I guess it depends on the detail. I think you had a question before.
Yeah, I have two questions actually. So the first one is related to the question of this another. At the continuous level in your elasticity calculation, do you try to include some plasticity, something which arose from some information? Because it's a quite strong assumption. You assume it's pure elasticity, the microscopic level, you have forces that diverge with a different strong assumption. So if you put a little bit of plasticity, then.
Yeah, I guess, no, I haven't tried to do that, and I guess that's something definitely to do, yeah. Yeah, I guess that would be a way to see analytically if, you know, something that is not fully attached by springs or whatever could still have the same effect, at least of stability, right? I should do that for sure. Yeah.
And the second question is about the energy cascade.
Yeah.
Do you have some evidence for an energy transfer related to nonlinear coupling?
Yeah.
Local dissipation of energy, which is a different thing.
Yeah, so in a very, very simple toy calculation that I started, you could see that the lower modes, that there was this energy transfer to lower modes, but it becomes quickly complicated, and I haven't had the time to look further into that. I mean, I guess my argument of energy cascade is the fact that when it's linear, of course, the nonlinear coupling between the modes will not be as important as this dissipation. And there in the dispersion relation, this initial results, we can see that when it's linear, it's enough to have decoupled modes, that the higher modes will dissipate quicker. But when it's nonlinear, the fact that there you will necessarily be coupling elastic modes, different case up and down, right, through your nonlinear interactions. And the numerical observation of the way that happens is what tells me that there's a cascade. But beyond a very simple version in which I'm not including everything, I haven't really done that. And that's another thing to do, for sure.
So looking at the simulation, you have your arrows.
Yeah.
And you said that you were looking at this arrow in order to find the H parameter, or the magnetization, if you want.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that you were observing a long-range order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what I don't understand, if I think of your arrow moving around, and I think of that like simply like a spin, and your interactions are short range,
mm-hmm.
and you are not changing your neighbors,
mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a question that appeared a lot at the beginning. But after talking a lot with John, who first said that it was impossible and then said it was trivial. that is often happens when we have this discussion with people who are very much into theory, is the fact that this is only applies to the alignment term without really considering the elastic deformations, right? I mean, if you think of a purely elastic system, you can have something equivalent to alignment because they're moving collectively, right? Because of just the collective modes of your system. So the Mermin-Wagner theorem really doesn't apply once you're considering these kind of deformations, which are effectively long range.
The lowest mode is long range.
Sorry?
The lowest mode.
Right. The lowest mode, for example, is long range, or oscillation of anything is long range.
It's carried by deformations, and deformations are not considered.
Right. Oops. Just. Yeah. So yeah. So it takes a little to right. Yeah. I guess it's
yeah. So
I don't know. I guess my bias is not towards thinking that it's impossible. So sometimes it's hard for me to understand why it seems so impossible to some people. But I would tell you to talk to John to have a deep conversation about why that is possible in that case. But we can also discuss more. Sure, I can. Thank you, Gabriel.
You showed this phase transition. Is this something like the excitic phase?
The what, sorry?
The excitic phase.
I don't.
The Mermin-Wagner does not fit all of the existence of the excitic phase.
Oh, right. Exactly. So this is because we're coupling these translation to the orientation. I guess that comes out like that. Yeah, I guess so. But I really wouldn't be able to say like for sure. Yeah.
So probably it's a question follow up on Karen's question. And so I think you mentioned that if you get rid of the coupling to velocity, then you would not have this collective behavior, right?
Yeah.
So I think in
speed,
in a model where a particle can move around, this active velocity actually kind of convects this order
mm-hmm.
to the system,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's why if you get rid of velocity, then there's no convection, and we probably would not have this large long-range order. But in your case, when you get rid of this coupling to velocity, what are you actually getting rid of to destroy this collective behavior?
Because
I'm changing. Anyway.
Right, they're not changing anyway. So the only thing I'm doing is that instead of being able to decelerate or accelerate, they're always keeping a constant speed. right? In practice, that's what I'm doing. And, you know, I'm not sure how to explain what I'm doing sort of wrong to destroy the long range, the order in general, not even long range, the short range order too, except for thinking in terms of these elasticity dynamics. So I can give you a different example very quickly. So Ulrich had looked at a coupling, you know, at a model with attraction repulsion too a while ago. And when they were going to zero alignment, because it also had alignment, they never really were aligning, right? So our interpretation of that, because we tried it actually, is that in this typical big chick model, which is what they were doing at the time, you switch your direction immediately to your fully relaxed direction. Okay? So when you do that in this case, you also cannot organize. And my interpretation is that you're kind of overshooting the right pathway to cascading your modes. So essentially, as you're turning very quickly, you're always exciting higher modes again. You know? And I think that a way I see it intuitively of what I'm doing when I get rid of that coupling with the speed is a similar thing. As I'm turning, I'm still injecting always a lot of energy because I'm craving a constant speed. So as I'm turning to my relaxed direction, I'm always re-exciting higher modes. That's the best intuitive way I see to I find to see. And for me, that's one of the powers of thinking in terms of elasticity, that you can have these intuitive arguments at that level.
All right. Thank you again. Just one.